Okay, hi and good evening, everyone. Welcome to this event by the Hellenic Observatory, the Center for Research on Contemporary Greece and Cyprus at the London School of Economics. It's a very great pleasure to have you here with us in this event, but also let me welcome our online audience who follows the event on the YouTube channel of the Hellenic Observatory. It's great to have you here, and also let me welcome the representatives from the High Commission of Cyprus, the Greek Embassy, but also the community here, the Cypriot community here in London. As you know, probably many of you know, a central part of what the Hellenic Observatory does is to foster informed, balanced, and rigorous debate on major political, economic, and societal issues. We touch upon issues that are sometimes very sensitive, sometimes very, very sensitive, but we always do that with what we believe is the respecting the LSE tradition on methodological rigor and evidence-based, balanced views. Events like the one today exactly fit to our mission. We have had this year many events on Greece, and in some way the event on Cyprus is well overdue, but I think it couldn't have been more timely as we speak. The Cyprus issue is evolving. Already I'm hearing, I was reading this morning about the news coming from Cyprus yesterday that there is a new optimism, cautious optimism, but still optimism, about the prospective, possible resumption of talks. And I think the broader consensus that things are getting a bit more mature, more serious about sort of creating a new dynamic for a new dialogue, at least, if not resumption of talks. And of course, the situation is not just coincidental. We have developments both in Cyprus, electoral outcomes in the north, in the south, but also we have developments around Cyprus, if you want, with everything happening in the Middle East and in Ukraine, a new geopolitical dynamic that doesn't, of course, necessarily directly implicate Cyprus, but also opens up questions about unresolved conflicts and reconciliation, constitutional arrangements, and so forth, that are at the very heart of the question of Cyprus. And we've seen not only, if you want, the demand side of this, that there's a need for that, but also the supply side. We see a renewed effort and some urgency also from international organizations, the United Nations, that actually seem to be more and more engaged. And I think the presence of the European Council, or the Council of the European Union, by the Republic of Cyprus has also helped to put a bit more visibility and urgency to the whole issue. So it's against this backdrop that we pose the question, which is central to our event tonight: can new prospects essentially overcome all the challenges? We know, and we've been debating for a long time, probably some people in the audience more than I have, but we've been debating for a long time all the constraints, the problems, the resistances, the difficulties, institutional, emotional, political, perhaps even economic, that keep the conflict frozen, if you want, or keep us away from the solution. It is interesting now to look a bit more forward and think what are the different dynamics that develop and how and whether they can help overcome the old challenges. These are existing challenges, but also challenges that need to be overcome. Now, to help us unpack, debate this issue, we're very, very privileged to have with us an expert panel of speakers bringing complementary perspectives from political science, conflict analysis, and from economics. And they will help us together, sort of, they will navigate us through a discussion on which I will invite you also to participate as audience. I will not give the long CV versions of the speakers, but just to say that our first speaker would be Professor Neophytos Loizidis, who's Professor of International Conflict Analysis at the University of Warwick, probably known to pretty much everybody in the room, but very much invested onto the topic and very much linked with both the academic and the policy side of the Cyprus issue. Our second speaker is Dr. Sinem Arslan, who's a visiting fellow here at the Hellenic Observatory. Sinem was previously at the University of St. Andrews and the University of Essex, and she is doing very important and very inspiring work on the Turkish Cypriot community and the relation with Turkey. Our third speaker moves away from the politics and the conflict studies and comes from economics. Professor Alex Michaelides is Professor of Finance at Imperial College Business School, and he's done work also on the Cyprus unification issue, some in the past, but also increasingly, I hope we'll see more of it in the near future. So these are my introductory remarks. Let me tell you a couple of housekeeping things. We'll have the presentation by the speakers. Perhaps a little time will take for the reflective discussion among the panel, and then we'll open it up to the floor. You'll have the opportunity to ask your questions. When you please ask your questions in the form of a question rather than a long manifesto type of statement, and try to identify yourself very quickly, so some sort of notion of affiliation, and then we will want to spend more time for more questions rather than long, as I said, statements. The event is being obviously broadcasted and will be recorded. I think there's a hashtag that is called LSE Cyprus. Very good. Hashtag LSE Cyprus for those versed on social media. And that's all for me. We will follow the order in the order I presented the speaker. So let me invite Professor Neophytos Loizides to the floor. Thank you very much.
I will follow Vasilis in the auditorium. I like speaking from this position. A wise Cypriot politician said once that the Cypriot negotiations is like the World Cup. You have most of the people who are hardly interested and do not follow the events or just read the regular press, and you have a small dedicated group of people who always read and talk about the Cyprus question. But every 5, 10 years, when we have big negotiations, everybody is watching the negotiations like the World Cup. And the irony this time, the negotiations are happening at the time that you have a World Cup, which is probably a good. It's a good sign that things might work positively this time around. IRA used to say, our enemies need to be always successful. We need to succeed only once. So in terms of the Cyprus negotiations, what we know so far in the past few weeks, we know that the United Nations are starting a new process. When I was in New York last week, I heard that Cyprus is one of the two priorities of António Guterres before he leaves and hands his position to his successor, possibly a woman from the Americas. There are, of course, the dark horses. We don't know who might be eventually selected, might be surprised with an appointment. But the effort is either to bring a solution to the Cyprus problem by the end of the year, which for many of us sounds a surprise, why so quickly, or reach a level of agreement, a strategic agreement that would enable his successor to do so successfully. And he himself receives some of the credit. We don't know the specific motivations why the UN is pushing for that right now. It might be for sure the legacy of the United Nations. The UN might have some regrets of how they handled Crans-Montana. We can discuss who is to be blamed, who is to be blamed for Crans-Montana. We can do an autopsy of the negotiation, not only from the positions of the side, but from the methodology of the negotiations at the UN. Has used at the time. One key motivation for the United Nations is that according to them, there is a change in the position in Turkey. So there are questions about Turkish foreign policy that Sinem and Alex will answer in terms of economics and geopolitics. Why Turkey now and what are the incentives? And do we have enough in the table for Turkey to change its position? From our side, we've been talking to the UN for more than 5 years now, telling something very important that most people are not aware of. that public opinion in cyber in both communities has been changing over years, and that we have seen an increase in the support of Federation. It was clearly demonstrated in Erdogan's elections, not so much in the parliamentary elections in the Greek Cypriot community, because in parliamentary elections, usually local issues are being discussed. But this is something we have seen for years now, and matter significantly. So for the first time, if you wish, in recent history, the Cyprus negotiations tick a lot of boxes. Public opinion being in favor, or at least not being against. Or if they are totally against, there's no point in having negotiations. If people are so and so and ready to tolerate solutions, then the endorsement of political parties will make it easier. So if you have the incentives that are coming from the international community, you're more likely to succeed because people are not unconditionally against the settlement. The second box you take is Turkey's. Turkey not saying no. They might not say yes, but they might be giving a sign that they're willing to agree on a process. And third, we don't have elections or significant elections for the remaining 6 months. So we tick the election box and the UN box as well. I rarely use a point that this is the last chance, because the Cyprus problem is there to keep bothering us and keep creating issues for both global geopolitics. I recently gave a talk to Deutsche Welle, and one of the titles, Deutsche Welle changes its title when they make videos, it was EU and NATO cannot ignore Cyprus. They reported at the level that they cannot ignore us. We created a momentum in the negotiations. We annoy enough the international community to pay attention to us. And this is a success of the peace movement of Cyprus, of the leadership in Cyprus, of the bicommunal voices in Cyprus, but we receive the attention of the international community. So now there is an opportunity to capitalize on this. So here, this is a toolkit that a colleague of mine, Haris Psaltis from the University of Cyprus, has created. I don't know if this is shared online, so people online could see. But basically, we have the following questions. We've been seeing for many years the support for Bizona by communal federation has been going up. But then people are asking us, what kind of Bizona by communal federation do you imagine people understand it? So we created a survey experiment where we're giving people packages of different types of Transmontana settlements. We took the Transmontana, we play a little bit with that. We created sub-variations. We randomly selected those when people received them in public opinion polls. They selected one or the other, and then they said whether they're going to vote. They did this five times, times 1,000 people from each community or so. And here we created a reader of how people can read the data. So you can have that in your home and play all night tonight and find the 108 solutions of the Cyprus problem according to that. It was funded by the Hellenic Observatory. Sorry, I forgot to mention that this came out of your own generous funding of the Hellenic Observatory. So here you can see, for instance, thinking of political structure. I'll choose, I like parliamentary system, so I'll go for the parliamentary system. Territorial arrangements, I like more for North Carpathia to become federal areas. Compensations, you can get your property back, or if that's not possible, 300,000 plus properties. Security guarantees, you can choose NATO, Ireland, France, and Germany, Japan, Australia, Canada. I'll go for as far away as possible. Very quickly, there is a proposal to have Supreme Court in Cyprus, or even have the UN tribunal making decisions in Cyprus. That's my good friend Takis Hagidimi Hagigeorgiou idea. And then we also discussed, because it was a project from the Hellenic Observatory that involved energy, having a type of investment in the buffer zone. So we choose those dimensions, and then we check acceptability here. And manage to solve the Cyprus development. If the 7% support. I can even dare to do a natural gas pipeline from Turkey and check acceptability. Let's see this one, because if we give Turkey the natural gas, the pipeline, we're not going to give them the natural gas. We're going to sell the pipeline. Yeah, we are pacifists, right? Let's see if that passes the test. Because the Greek and Cypriots were not willing to accept that.
Think it did update the result.
It did update.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, so it reduced a little bit the Greek Cypriot, but it's still within the zone of possible. Thank you. Within the zone of possible agreement. So even a dimension that often doesn't look in isolation acceptable to the Greek Cypriots, if you put it in a conjoint experiment and everything else works, it's acceptable. And this is a classic game of negotiations. Any trainer in negotiations, a few of you here, Yashim here, any game theorist in economics will tell you that you need to bring packages together. Otherwise, it's impossible to get very difficult to get a settlement. And things that do not seem acceptable, like political equality in public opinion polls in isolation, if you add them in a package, in a comprehensive package where you get territory, you get security, you get compensations for people who do not get their properties back, you get the acceptable zone of agreement. So it's a lot of optimism right there. But as citizens, we have to be very cautious. We very much understand the political situation in Turkey. A Turkish activist, Turkish Cypriot activist, once said it: when you're driving with Erdogan, a Turkish leader, you have to be very careful if he's driving in front of you because he might be signaling left and he might be going right. Right? There is a mavi vatan. And similar concerns around the Turkish Cypriot community. Often we give the similar mixed messages as Greek Cypriots of what we're aiming to do. So both sides fear each other's intentions, even though we have a momentum. And that's a classic, again, negotiation game. How do you reduce uncertainty? We never been so close in terms of the actual positions. The difference between Greek and Turkish Cypriot positions, Krasmadana, is not that significant. It's not even, it's a paradox that we spent a decade almost after being so close and didn't even have a discussion, a summit to see whether we can bridge the difference. But what is significant is that we differ in terms of the methodology. The Greek Cypriots would like to see a restart of the negotiation where it was stalled. The Turkish Cypriots want to see a new methodology where there are guaranteed consequences for the side that does not deliver in the talks. And that's where we're discussing right now. That's the purpose of the whole thing. It's a classic uncertainty game where the sides do not trust each other. We have a question of trust. The Greek Cypriot side is mostly on the implementation side. On the Turkish Cypriot side is more on the adoptability side. How do we adopt an agreement if we know that the Greek Cypriots might let us down again? And usually those they come up with negotiation theories. If you give them to me, not as a Greek Cypriot, but as a negotiation theorist, I would say that you introduce a couple of mechanisms, deadlock resolving mechanisms, and forms of guarantees in the process. In the English foreign policy discourse, we often discuss this as a backstop, where you start the negotiations and you know in advance of the negotiations that both sides have given something in the start of the process. So every side is looking at their benefits from the beginning of the negotiation, have guaranteed benefits. The Turkish Cypriots have talked about guaranteed consequences, which is also another way of thinking of this. That's more difficult to implement in my view. Others say that we don't need to think so much about those types of guarantees. We need to discuss a lesser procedure and restart the negotiations, because if we haven't talked about the Cyprus negotiations for such a long time, there is a problem with re-engaging with the public. And in fact, one of the efforts in the current negotiations is to bring in the cities, citizen assemblies, bring the citizens in the process. This is one of the major progress points in the negotiations. You're going to have civic assemblies. You might get a phone call anytime by your leader who say you're going to represent Cyprus in the negotiations, and you're going to spend 3 weeks discussing the Cypriot questions with Turkish Cypriots, and whatever you decide, you're going to get the chance for us, we're gonna give you the chance to shape the negotiations. This is revolutionary for the Cyprus negotiations, but it's not unprecedented. I've been involved in places like New Caledonia, where things like that, or Bosnia, where things like that are being introduced right now. But for us, it's a new method, it's a new approach to deal with this. So my prediction of what to conclude, of what I think it will happen, I think it's more likely to have some kind of mixed method summit in the next few months, where all these are going to be discussed, and maybe the best idea will prevail at the end. Thank you.
Thank you, Neofyte. I think there's a lot of optimism here that we would like to cling on. But let me invite now Sinem to tell us a bit of the story from another
I think it
perspective.
was the optimistic side, and I have much, cautious attitude. So, how do I? So hello everyone. So yesterday's meeting between UN envoy Mariangela Holguin and Cypriot leaders, and together with the announcement of the expanded 5+1 meeting later this summer, actually renew hopes about revived hopes about a renewed settlement. Yet for many observers, including myself, Ankara's support for the renewed diplomatic engagement appears somewhat surprising. For many years, in the past, Turkish government have supported major reunification initiatives. In 2004, Ankara strongly backed the Annan Plan, contributing to the 65% approval rate of the plan. In 2014, it was Ankara that persuaded Derviş Eroğlu, who had been highly reluctant to support a joint declaration with Nikos Anastasiades. Again, during Crans-Montana process, the Turkish government agreed to discuss the future of guarantee system. However, the development since the collapse of Crans-Montana, actually, Turkish approach to Cyprus appeared to move precisely the opposite direction, with Turkey consistently backing a two-state solution and expanding its intervention in the north of the island. Based on 3 years' fieldwork in the self-declared Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus and 70 in-depth interview with a Turkish Cypriot politician and a public opinion survey, my research examined Turkish Cypriot perception of Turkey's changing role in the island and with some implication over the reunification effort. So, the elite interview reveals that actually the 2020 leadership election in the self-declared Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus actually marked a turning point in the relations between Turkey and Turkish Cypriot community. Well, actually, we knew that Turkey's influence has increased in the north of Cyprus since 1974, and actually this turned into a dependency relation since the unilateral declaration of independence of the de facto entity. And also we knew that Turkish government actually interfered in Turkish Cypriot politics. But however, this intervention have been happening behind closed door majority of time. However, since 2020, actually, Turkish government started to intervene quite assertively and with public visibility. Since then, we actually saw that this intervention have expanded in scope and actually, extended in political, military, social affairs. And it's actually got quite institutionalized on the, through economic and social, economic and financial protocols, as well as development and economic cooperation, sorry, office. At the regional level, Ankara became more actively engaged in Eastern Mediterranean through the Blue Homeland Doctrine and started maritime delimitation, sorry, a signed maritime delimitation agreement with Libya in 2019, and started offshore drilling activities in the Eastern Mediterranean. So Turkish Cypriots' response to Ankara's expanding intervention actually was quite, quite. I mean, they were quite dissatisfied, and there were like lots of societal protests, including March for Democracy and Will in 2020 after the elections, and no picnic over pain demonstration in again in 2020, and protests opposing the liberalization of headscarf in high schools in 2025. So we were curious to see like what the public opinion think about Turkish intervention in their political affairs. So apparently 84% of the whole population are quite dissatisfied. Again, 88% of the population is also dissatisfied about economic dependency on Turkey. Actually, these percentages are quite noteworthy considering that political expression actually may lead to entry restriction in Turkey, and where 89% of the whole population think that freedom of expression is actually quite problematic in the north of the island. Immigration is actually another point of contention between Turkey and Turkish Cypriot community. Actually, we don't know the exact number of the immigrants, and although they are not a homogeneous community, actually they are perceived as like, pursuing Ankara's agenda, which is not always the case eventually. But nonetheless, 79% of the population actually think that immigration for Turkey is problematic. However, the relations between Turkey and Turkish Cypriot community is much complex and actually dominated by persistent security fears. 81% of the community believe there is a possibility of renewed conflict, and they have a very low level of intercommunal trust. It's only, I mean, 72% think President of Republic of Cyprus is untrustworthy. 77% don't trust Greek Cypriots. And eventually, the interview with a Turkish Cypriot politician revealed that security fears intensified with the Republic of Cyprus security partnership over the last years, and with regional conflicts in Iran and as well as Palestine. Rise of Elam eventually contributed to the security fears. And we find it very, very interesting that across parties, people like political elites was thinking that there is a possibility of the de facto entity becoming the next Palestine in the future. And that's exactly why actually we see that Turkey actually perceived as the only reliable ally. Actually, Turkish military with 89% considered as one of the most trustworthy institutions in the de facto entity. 79% think that TRNC should allow the stationing of Turkey's troops and bases. And when it comes to military alliance, this actually jumps to 89%. And even during the Iran war, we have seen segments of the left who are very critical of the military, Turkish military, actually supporting the deployment of F-16. So actually, the security issue is a quite an important dynamic in this relationship. And then we also see that Turkish Cypriot community have lack of trust towards international actors' ability to actually resolve the issue, Cyprus question. Only 32% trust guarantor states in terms of their ability to find a peaceful solution. When it comes to UN, this percentage drops to 19%. And Turkish government is actually among the most trusted among the guarantor states, but nonetheless, that's only 50%. And eventually, there is a lack of trust. I mean, probably not surprisingly, considering low level of intercommunal trust, also security issue, not, I mean, low level of trust to international actors. Turkish Cypriot communities quite skeptical in terms of their belief in bizonal bicommunal federation. Only 17% think this might be realistic. 52% think this is not realistic because Greek Cypriot community would oppose it. 16% think Turkey would oppose it. 5% think Turkish Cypriot community would oppose it. And 3% think that another state would oppose it. So under these circumstances, I think we should interpret Turkey and Turkish Cypriot approach to reunification efforts. For Turkish Cypriots, the main issue is security. And apart from being the guarantor or the dependency relationship, Turkey is seen by, I mean, even the segments of the left as the most trustworthy ally. So this should be taken into consideration. And also, they have been quite a disappointment about former reunification efforts, how this hasn't been concluded. So Erhurman's methodology, which actually requires talk to be based on political equality, built on previous agreements, have a clear timeline, and ensure that failure does not lead back to status quo should be understood from this perspective. For Turkey, I'm unfortunately not very optimistic because considering the nationalist alliance between Nationalist Movement Party and Justice and Development Party, and considering that actually Erdogan would like to extend his tenure in the as a president, thereby I think the room for maneuver in terms of Cyprus talks would be quite limited for Turkey. But I hope I will be mistaken in this respect. So I think while the recent diplomatic developments have created a cautious optimism, renewed settlement effort will need to address Turkish Cypriot security concern, political equality demands, and broader regional and domestic politics shaping Ankara's approach to the issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Sinem. Very interesting and very well timed. I guess this brings creates a bridge because there's the security concern that brings the Turkish Cypriot community closer to Turkey, but also the economic concern that has seemed to pull them further apart. So, Alex, I guess that passes the floor to you to talk to us about the economics of reunification.
Yeah, so thanks. This is so I come to it more from the economic slash finance side. I'm going to air my frustration with the processes. So kind of if you look at the Cyprus problem, every 10 years there's a big negotiation. These are kind of the so now we're in the last one. Now the problem is that in between these 10-year periods, my view is that they're not used as transparently and as productively as they should be, in the sense that there's a lot of complex issues from the economic side that you need to convince people that are going to take a big leap into the new United Cyprus economy, that they need to take that leap. So you need to convince them that they're going to be better off. Which is obviously what you start thinking about Palestinian conflict. That's not a very good way to look forward. And that doesn't exist only on the Turkey Cypriot side. It exists, I think, on the Greek Cypriot side. So the most fundamental problem in my mind is that people are afraid, and it has been mentioned in the past when these things have been discussed, that it's an irreversible decision. Once you sign, you go in one direction. You cannot backtrack. If things go wrong, you're stuck, and you don't. So therefore, you need to. This irreversibility has a name in finance. It's called a kind of a real option. So when you have a lot of uncertainty, there's value to waiting, basically. So you need to take smaller steps, and then, or at least, so there's incremental changes, and then over time, or you think better, or you think more, or you explain to the electorates what's the feasible way forward, and you think as much as possible of all the possible things that might happen that could go wrong, and then you try to figure it out. And my problem as a citizen, but then also as a thinking through these things, is that the discussion has not been as convincing as it should be. That it, in the sense that there's not much economic content, and I don't think. And this is not a negotiation between, when you are in the negotiating table. This is kind of a public discussion I'm thinking about. So you shouldn't worry about it. So I'm going to give four examples of this progressively getting worse. So the first is this presidential system. So there's different ways of designing presidential systems. So this goes into the idea that there's a Darona Semoglu and co-authors won a Nobel Prize for the importance of institutions. So you need to think about the institutions very carefully when you're designing these transitions. So the institution here would be, how do you design the presidency? Do you do a Swiss model where you have seven people and one top guy where they decide things, which was kind of more like the Annan plan? Or do you go with a go with a rotating presidency, for example? Those are two examples. My gut feeling, and we should test it with what Neofidos presented, is that the Swiss model would be, which is the Annan plan, would be more preferable. That's kind of the feeling I get when I talk to Greek Cypriots, at least on the Greek Cypriot side. But that's not what we have come to in 2017. So the question is, it's like how does this happen? And it would be good to know what people prefer and what would be more likely to lead to less gridlock and less confrontation. Because remember, this is a one-way street, basically. You cannot do it after you go down that path, which is kind of the main problem with this thing. So, but let's say this is not the big thing. Let's go to other things. So the central bank. So the central bank is an important institution in all economies. And in the since the 80s, there has been a trend of having legal ways of protecting the central bank, and this we call it the euro central bank independence has increased in many countries as a way to deal with potentially bad outcomes in inflation and volatility in the economy. Now, that doesn't mean, so I have a recent paper on this, but there's other recent papers by others that I don't have any references here. That doesn't mean that the de facto central bank independence will also go up in a society. So you can think of, and so if you look at the evidence from a cross section of countries, politicians have an inherent preference to undo what the Euro central bank independence is called the CISO effect. So the CISO effect is when you go and de facto you appoint who you want that they're going to do your bidding. So this became very took a lot of press coverage recently with the U.S. Case, but there's many other cases around the world. There's also in that part of the world where you appoint your personal banker. Let's say that's what happened in Lebanon. And the outcome was very bad eventually. Or you can appoint your son-in-law, let's say, so to be a central bank governor. So you want to avoid these outcomes. And there's nothing, that I've seen in the negotiations that prevents anybody who gets in this presidential system to make these appointments in that particular way. So I could easily see how this could create trouble, basically. So I want, as a citizen, to be assured that this has been thought through, has been explained, and there's guarantees in place that this is not going to happen. And the ECB will not be a solution. Even if you go and you become a member of the Eurozone and the ECB is there, the ECB will not go and undo your appointment. That's not how it works. The ECB will accept who you appoint. So you need to figure it out exactly locally that you're not. This is not going to happen. So that's a second example. And this is important because these guys have to go and figure out the different bank balance sheet data across the two countries. You need to have the good data, you need to analyze it, you need to do it in a neutral, in a good way. So that's issue number two. Issue number three is the federal debt. So there's a classic problem in federations. So Belgium is the one that is the classic example where debt to GDP always goes up because you cannot agree how to constrain expenditures. I've seen nothing in all of these negotiated agreements of how this is not going to happen in Cyprus. So, in fact, if you go and look, especially on the actually on the Turkey Cypriot side, it's not even clear whether the grants that Turkey has given to the Turkey Cypriot side, whether they're considered debt or whether they're just grants, whether just help that is not going to be, needed back. Even if you agree on that and you figure out something, you need to have some constraints. So you need to design this before you negotiate. But because for some reason there's no economist in these negotiations, and this applies also to the UN, there's not much understanding of how these, Maastricht type criteria, which I have here, are going to be implemented. So this is kind of repeating. So it's not exactly clear right now whether the financial aid from Turkey is treated as debt or grant on one side. For example, there's hidden contingent liabilities through the banking system. And that was the 2013 Cyprus crisis, where you had a lot of assets that became that the state had to manage to bail out, and they couldn't. But that could also happen with state-owned enterprises on both sides. So therefore, you need a clear analysis of where you stand on both sides before essentially deciding on a merger. So you need a due diligence project because you're thinking of it as a merger. So you need to do it in a transparent, independent way. So this needs to be done to convince both sides of the stability of embarking into the unknown. So recall this real options approach that predicts very strongly that there is value to waiting in the presence of significant underlying uncertainty in the value of a project. So that's kind of, so you need to, and this, and I think in the back of the mind, people have the correct intuition that in the face of all this uncertainty, you need to convince them that they need to take the plunge, but you need to show them the evidence. And the most difficult problem, I think, which requires a lot of data and a lot of work. And that's why I think this 10-year intervening period should have been used in a productive way, is how to deal with these property issues. So there's monumental changes in land values since 1974. It's not clear who owns what, whether there's mortgages on these properties, foreign buyers, domestic buyers. Then you need to think about potentially designing a tax system that will have some redistributive mechanism, because if this works, land values will go further up. Potentially, this has a large potential fiscal cost. So you need to think about a clearly and credibly financed mechanism. Is somebody else going to come and give you the money as a foreign donor? Which, given everything else that's happening in the world, why would they give it to Cyprus? Not obvious to me. So you need to think about all of these things and have a credible plan about how these will work. So you need a lot of detail in the data sets, basically, to think about how this property fund will be designed, whether it, and again, going back to the central bank issue, if you are going to design a property fund, it's potentially going to be a federal fund, potentially it's going to have some fund managers. These fund managers should be appointed in a way that it's not politically biased, basically. So it should be appointed, so there should be some, some mechanism of figuring out from on both sides that these people can get along and they can talk to each other and can reach decisions, basically. So the process for these appointments was the same point as the central bank appointments. So the main takeaway, the main point I want to make, is that you need a wider public discussion to help articulate this vision of how this will work, basically. And I was hoping there would be some more time, actually, to have a transparent, like a technocratic kind of groundwork that we'll have through a public discussion, which is a bit similar to what Nevdos just presented, but have it on more on the economic side to convince people that this will not break down. Because I do think that, and these institutional details matter ex ante, you need to figure it out ex ante in a transparent manner, rather than after the fact. And that's kind of the main uncertainty that people have in mind, in that fear. In my mind, people fear that things might become a Palestine. It's not just the Turkish Cypriots, I think, that fear about Palestine. They might be more explicit in saying it, but the Greek Cypriots also fear that, in the sense that it's very hard to think about how these will merge and not break down, basically. So you need to figure out all of these. At least have a plan of what might happen and how you're going to react before this happens, in a credible way, which is difficult, but it's something that needs to be done. And it's not obvious to me that, with the partial information I have, it's not clear to me that this has been discussed on the, from the economics or and finance side in the negotiating teams. And that's all I have.
Thank you, Alex. Come join us. Before I open the Q&A, can I ask one question to each of the speakers? So use my prerogative and ask the first question. So, Alex, In relation to your presentation, I think one of the assumptions I make for, whenever the Cyprus issue is resolved is that you will need some sort of developmental aid coming from what is now the Republic of Cyprus to the north. I don't want to make the, I will though, make the analogy between the reunification of Germany and obviously very different kind of political or kind of national identity dimension there, but it may require that, and that may be even more difficult than whether they agree on the appointment of the central bank or even for the properties, which is a very hot issue. So, do you think developmental aid would be necessary, and would that be a bigger obstacle than the institutional design of the macroeconomic institutions?
Well, they're both, I think, important. It might seem that these institutional details are easier to fix. I mean, but they're easier to fix in theory. I mean, de facto, I don't think they're as easy because you always want to appoint somebody who is closer to you. But then, if you have two on both sides, they think the same, then it could easily create a problem. So you need to think about a structure where they both agree on appointing people who will talk to each other and not destroy, what they're trying to build. Now, the developmental side, we need, I don't know. I mean, I haven't seen in the previous time in 2004, and even 2017, there was some discussion. In 2004, there was a discussion there was going to be a World Bank donor conference, and they were going to give some money. But it's not obvious to me, with all the problems that the world has right now, that anybody will give anybody. And then to ask the Cypriot government to give money, I don't think that will go down very well with the Greek Cypriots. The Greek Cypriots will say, "Well, Turkey should give the money." So you need some, So I don't know how much money you need. I don't know how, potentially, if this works and there's a unification, property values will go up, and with a smart design of a tax system, you can figure out a way of making this property fund be liquid in a particular way that could. That could work, but you need to think about all of these issues, and that's my point. And then, try to have different models down there and try to figure out which one has the highest chances of success, because I haven't even seen any data down. And this data changes every 10 years. It's not just that time passes, values pass, population change on the ground. I mean, there's a lot of things that happen all the time. And I haven't seen any study that does like a structure in like a what the these property values are, how much money will be needed, how this will work.
I'm hearing we need to fund another project on the economics of Cyprus. Neofita, would you
But
like to?
this is exactly the essential questions we haven't been asking. If we had a stalemate for such a long time, it could have been very useful if we have inquired the big donors, whether they are ready to contribute, because that's the preparatory work you normally do. It's still not late. We still have time to do so. And the best argument you can make in international politics is that we need to invest in peace. And big communities such as the European Union are willing, I think, to do so. But it's a question of putting our demands there on the table. Now, federations have ways to redistribute wealth, and usually this is through their tax system. This is not going to be a Turkish Cypriot, Greek Cypriot only exchange. It's going to be between the two constituent states as well. And the Turkish Cypriot constituent state, or the northern constituent state, would also have Greek Cypriot population. There are going to be people who are going to be returning. Now, most people don't know that in federations, you could be working in one side of the federation, but residing on the other side of the federation. Where do you pay taxes in? Where you get your money or where you live? Does anybody know?
Where you will.
In every federation is where you live, because that's where you get services, right? So if tomorrow 50,000 Greek Cypriots return to the north, that's the financial aid you need for the Turkish Cypriot constituency. Most people don't know that. I mean, this will come automatic by the virtue of return. Alex mentioned the question of properties and how we create the monetary tools through the property. So partly it will be self-funded, the settlement, through natural gas, through properties, through taxation. And partly we need to push on this dimension from external donors and compensations that will come from outside. But these are again the questions. I think the developmental part is not so problematic. I think most federations providing aid is not the biggest problem. The biggest question is immobilism, when you cannot make decisions. And this is what Alex hinted with the presidential system and with the weak deadlock mechanism that we had in many federal systems. Some of the ideas, and you can decide in this room which one you prefer. So imagine a scenario where we have a major financial crisis, like it happened in 2013, and we need to make a decision and we cannot. Like, take that counterfactual. The decision could be made either by lottery. That's one of the issues that was discussed. It could be made by the sitting president, which means that if he happens to be a Turkish Cypriot, he can make the devastating decision, the Greek Cypriot could. And for the Greek Cypriots, that's important because the Greek Cypriot side contributes maybe 80% of the population, but 90% of the economy. So it's the biggest stakeholder in the. Or it could be done by some kind of arbitration where the needs of each side are being taken in the in the in the in, into consideration. So these are the options you have when you're dealing with these situations. If you ask my opinion, I'll go certainly with arbitration. I wouldn't leave it to luck. It's too risky. I wouldn't leave it to the sitting president. I will go for a neutral body that I know it will be trusted. But these questions are a marathon. Sometimes in negotiations, you need to convince a lot of people about institutional design. But if we fail on any of the details, we're going to be suffering for decades to come. There's no way, maybe with Alex on this 100%, there's no way you can change the system easily. Because once you agree on something between the two communities, you will stick with the consequences.
I think
All the work
Bosnia
has to
has
be
a
done
bit of
now.
an experience on this one.
Every country, yeah.
Can I bring Sinem into that? Because you mentioned the issue of security and how much the question of security changes the perception of the Turkish Cypriot population in favor of Turkey, even if they find Turkey to be too interventionist and so forth. Do you get a sense from your own field work and your knowledge, of course, of also the political elite, but also the people? Is there any trade-offs between what I would call kind of hard security versus economic security? So is there a process by which you can say, okay, you fear that there may be conflict or that the northern part may become a new Palestine or whatever, but there is a process by which you will, increasingly be more financially secure in your own, not at the macro level, but in your own lived experience. Would that create a trade-off that would shift population more in favor of a reunification?
Don't think so. I mean, my observation, I don't think so. I mean, to be honest, I wasn't expecting the security fears to be that pervasive and that high. And I wasn't expecting, to be honest, to hear from across the political spectrum, we can be the next Palestine. Or I was, I was observing, left-wing politicians who are quite skeptical about the presence of Turkish soldiers and troops. But then all of a sudden, during the Iran war, it was like, you know what? Like, thank you to Turkey, like there are like the F-16 and so on and so forth. So I don't think there is a trade-off. I absolutely don't think so. And I think that I think that one of the major issues is like how to tackle with the security issue, because I mean I spoke with one of the leaders of the Turkish Cypriot community, and I said, well, there is this presence of UN peacekeeping forces, but then why this Turkish soldiers are so trusted institution. So, and he told me that, well, Sinem, because like when there was conflict, it was Turkey who actually, relieved the security concerns of the community and not the UN. So, I think there is no trade-off here. I mean, that's my observation at least.
We can open it up to questions, please indicate that your panel if you would like to ask a question. So I'll start here with I think there's a microphone next to you that you may.
Yeah, Bernard Casey. I'd like to ask about economic relations, but also social relations that are certainly when I was sort of doing work in Cyprus, one of the things I was very aware of was cross-border labor movements, and there was a lot of that. I don't know because I have not looked recently, but does that still exist? That had its own economic implications because people were actually contributing into a social insurance system in the south and yet living in the north. That had its own implications for how things were going to be organized in any kind of future joint state, dual state, or whatever. But actually, the fact that people were moving across the border and working next to one another has some kind of implications for their relationships and the trust and confidence they have in doing things with one another. So I wondered from a social and an economic and a political context, you could comment upon that. Thank you.
Anybody like to take that?
I mean, my understanding is that there still is some. I mean, there is a back and forth across the two. I guess since 2003, I guess, but has gone up and down. I guess. I mean, it's still happening. I guess. I don't know. Do you have any more info? Did you ask in your survey about this or no?
No, we didn't go into that detail because the numbers are very small. It wouldn't be captured by the survey.
Have you looked into it or like?
No, it's not in our surveys, but I mean, I asked during the interviews eventually, like how they perceive the Greek Cypriot community, like because they're like, they pass. And so basically what I heard is, I mean, there's this more pro-peace community, and they were already, supporting reunification. But apart from that, I mean, those who are actually supporting the two-state solution, yes, they actually, travel, cross-border. But then they said, you know what? But in the evening we come home. So I don't know if it really contributes to a positive, perception, because the security fear, it's there.
Another question at the back.
Hi, hello. Agilos Khashoggilos, research associate of the Hellenic Observatory. I have a bit of a question that goes a bit beyond the presentations, but I'm just interested in asking it because we recently had elections in Cyprus, in the Republic of Cyprus, and which was for years known as being one of the most structured, perhaps the last major structured party system in Europe, where established political parties really mattered to the people that were able to structure the electorate. We're seeing really important changes now, changes that perhaps go even beyond what happens in other democracies. I remember from 2004, the referendum, how important the positions of political parties were in guiding the perceptions of voters there. So, looking forward, do you think that the changes that we see in Greek Cypriot party politics right now, looking forward, do you think that they would make it easier or more difficult to deliver the support of the people to some kind of negotiated solution in the future? I'm not familiar at all with the Turkish Cypriot party system, but perhaps Sinem can also discuss if we're seeing any similar changes going on there that perhaps could be relevant.
I can answer this one. We're dealing with two different situations. To begin with, we don't have many cases of peace referendums around the world, so we cannot draw on evidence. As far as I know, there might be one, maybe two, but not many referendums in the 21st century on peace issues that succeeded. So we're talking about a very rare phenomenon to get a referendum right, which talks to your presentation, Alex, that sometimes we make institutional decisions, we accept to have a referendum, but we never look at the track record of referendums when we agree to have referendums, because these are very difficult decisions. People might be willing to tolerate solutions, but may not be ready to vote for them. And there is a big difference between the two. So that was kind of an entrapment that we felt by committing to a referendum. We could have left it there as an option, but committing to it was a problematic decision. Now, in terms of the logistics, On the Turkish Cypriot side, you have a very strong peace movement that is more homogeneous, is more on the left, is more urban, is more secular. So this is easy to mobilize because the connections are there. On the Greek Cypriot side, it's much more fragmented because traditionally you have two parties who supported the federal line, but one is on the right, the other one's on the left. And the two, they never talk to each other. So it's an element of coordination there too. Also, then the Greek Cypriot side is divided. Refugees tend to be more pro-solution. So again, there is a division on the refugees, and the new political parties would tend to be not so accustomed to the campaigning. So I will imagine a very messy campaign on the Greek Cypriot side if we ever have a referendum. My preference, given how problematic it is that we have such a good settlement that all major political parties support it, and then it becomes an easy ratification because you get a lot of endorsements by political parties on the center, on the left, and on the right. Another idea that is circulating right now, you probably read it in the press, is not news. It's kind of considered also by the United Nations, is to have a solution to the Cyprus problem, reach a comprehensive solution, but have the referendum in 3 years from now. And in the process, we start some big steps, such as direct trade that the Turkish Cypriots want, some territorial readjustments. We have the return of Varosha. And then we have a referendum in 3 years. If the referendum succeeds, then we move to the comprehensive settlement that we agree. If it doesn't, then whatever concessions will happen until then, they stay. So the Greek Cypriots keep Varosha, the Turkish Cypriots keep direct trade. This is high risk type of arrangements, but they're trying to bypass the referendum risk. They're being debated. They have both pros and cons, and they have alternatives as
So
well.
that's consistent with Israel options approach that you take some steps actually to reduce the uncertainty and then you take the next step, basically. That's kind of an implication of the Israel options approach comes out of that, actually. You can claim that the model will predict that, actually. So that's kind of consistent with that way of proceeding, actually.
Provided that you have the right management of spoilers
No, that's true.
in
I
that
mean,
maybe 3 year period, then it works very well in theory yet. Yeah.
And do you think parties in the north can mobilize and keep the coherence of the voters in supporting, a solution that is going to be put forward?
Yes, I think, I mean, there is a increase, I mean, in the north in any case, because I mean they're very unhappy about the status quo. So I mean, I think that the situation there is more hopeful in terms of, reunification.
Yeah, potential for trade-offs there. There is some potential for trade-offs.
No, but one thing I would say to that question is a good question because you have a lot of I would call them upstarts basically who are contesting a market essentially on the political dimension, and they're very successful. But I think part of the reason they're successful is because they're saying the obvious, which is, why is this like this? And I'm challenging that. Why is it so difficult to sign up in the to vote? And it's like then the guy has a point. I mean, it's like I have a problem with that as well. So then if you think through all of this, if it's correct, the hypothesis that people do actually care a lot about their economic well-being and they're scared about taking this step, like rapid step, without things being explained to them and without having a credible, detailed, well thought out plan that is at least credible, like what Novido just said. I mean, sounds like a reasonable thing to try, but I haven't, but it hasn't. It's the first time I hear about it. So then, in Cyprus, the people might be more willing to try something like that. Then that will have broad support across the population, not the political parties, in the sense that it's something that could work. You can, if you have people who can present it well and explain that this has a chance of working, I think it would have it could generate support. But it's easier said than done, in the sense that there's a lot of complications that might arise in a climate of distrust and bad history, basically. So you need a lot of, you know, charismatic people to come forward and also to know the details of these plans to convince people, because people are afraid, I think, of what might happen, you know, in the bad scenario.
So I think the political parties manipulate the situation, for instance, in terms of federation, because the right wing, you know, just manipulate and says that, you know, if the federation talks start, then we will be the minority that it does, you know, like they don't actually go into the details what might happen, you know, the.
Okay, we'll take another. So no. This side is winning a lot in terms of questions. But, so we'll do questions. Let's move on this side. We'll take two questions here. One,
two. Hi, my name is Isaac Karipidis. I'm a foreign correspondent for Cypriot Media. My question goes to Dr. Asal, which is a practical question. Sorry if you mentioned it, I couldn't hear it. Who runs the research of the data you present? Is very important. How many people they were participated, when it took place, and what kind of method you use to come up with this data?
Basically, for the public opinion surveys, it was a representative population sampled from 6 different districts in Cyprus. Actually, it was like, I think 473 male and the rest is female. So it's a representative for the whole population. And the interview data, it's actually around over 70 people, including leaders of Turkish Cypriot community, politicians, chief negotiators, experts, and journalists and academics. So I actually looked at different information with different, you know, samples. For instance, with Turkish Cypriot political elites, I asked them about their experience, like day-to-day experience with Turkey's intervention while they were in the office. While, for instance, for the expert, I asked questions such as, like, how this intervention have evolved over time. So to capture the nuances, like how... like what the population think.
Yeah, if I can add to that, we now have the introduction of the participatory methods in the Cypriot negotiations. So one of the convergences is that random citizens will be selected, and there will be in rooms like that, Greek Cypriots, Turkish Cypriots discussing some of these issues. I think this is very important because we're talking about random citizens, not experts, people who come here with clear mind. We perhaps give them some ideas, but they decide how to shape the negotiations. And theory of deliberative democracy says that this is extremely useful, and this avoids some of the biases that experts will have. Another innovation is that we now created panels, the Greek Cypriot side. So these are people who register with survey companies, and we can reach them anytime. And you can get results. Let's say we have a negotiation. You can get your results from a survey, again, with a representative sample, within a day or two. And we're trying to extend that with the Turkish Cypriot. We're handling that with the Turkish Cypriot community right now. So when we get into the negotiations, we might be able to get data very quickly from the citizens. Also, there are a lot of AI softwares that we're using right now, where you can have a dialogue like this. And some of my colleagues at the University of Cyprus, such as Haris Psaltis, are using in assemblies. And AI can give you the consensus of the discussion, which is also very, very important, something that we needed hours to analyze among ourselves. And it came with biases. You can use in deliberative discussions. So these are some of the instruments that can bring the two communities closer to each other, and we can test a lot of trade-offs, confidence-building measures, methodologies, very quickly and with more accuracy.
Thank you. My name is Rauf Jundi. I'm actually Lebanese, but married to a Cypriot, and has a strong interest in the Cyprus issue. My question is a little bit different to other questions. There's been a new dynamic in the region, in that the Republic of Cyprus has got closer to Israel in the past few years. to the point of having signing a security alliance together with Greece and Israel. And if there is any solution to a federal solution, I imagine this could be an issue or a hurdle, well, at least for Turkish Cypriot side, having being part of a federal government with a security alliance with Israel could be a hurdle. Has this been addressed at all? Has it been discussed? Is it an issue to be resolved, or has it been talked about?
Let me take another question before we need to bundle them. Was there another question from that side? Yes.
Wait, look at my question. This is the question. The findings.
I don't know. Yeah, but we need for the audience.
Yeah, online.
The hearing.
Well, point. I think your research came up with some very interesting findings. One of the questions that would be interesting to ask would be that what happens in the event of a new settlement that would require, we don't know yet the proportion, but certainly a proportion of Turkish Cypriots giving up their properties or properties, whatever they occupy at the moment, and relocating. I think the Anand plan had specific timetables for certain areas that would have been evacuated, and that was an issue because there were no guarantees of implementation that made many Cypriots fearful of these promises never being implemented. So is this a real fear? Is this a real anxiety? Is this a consideration by the Turkish Cypriots?
I asked actually this question. I was expecting that people would be less likely to support a reunification when they have to return property. But apparently that's not the case. Because, statu quo is so unbearable for the Turkish Cypriot community. It's around 98% is actually... they simply want a solution, no matter what the solution. So they're willing to actually, return property. This is actually not the main concern. The main concern is, are we going to be a minority in the new, federation? How are going to be, like the security guarantees? So, we don't want Turkey to actually leave up security guarantees. But then on the other hand, from the Greek Cypriot side, this is eventually quite not acceptable. So I think that the main issue, my observation, it's always a security, it's not the property.
Yeah.
We need to reply to the question about the security agreement in Israel. Who would like to?
The security on
Israel.
Oh, yeah, the security question with Israel is very important. We can look to the solution to that, which means if Cyprus reunifies, the Turkish Cypriots will be represented in all organs, have effective participation according to Paragraph 11 of the UN report that defines political equality. So that means decisions will be made with the Turkish Cypriots. And given that there is a Greek Cypriot left who is also skeptical on this direction, they will form a natural majority. So Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriots together will probably have a very neutral foreign policy. So that will come to a solution. For the time being, any sort of major geopolitical chessboard game in the region always risk of putting both pressure and alienating the other side. So it's a question of how much medicine can kill the patient, isn't it? But I think in terms of the long-term vision, this will be one of the results of the reunification of Cyprus. Cyprus will be a neutral place. Cyprus is too small to influence developments in the Middle East, but it's big enough to inspire similar solutions, peace, reconciliation throughout the region. So that's what we're looking forward in terms of the settlement. Now, in terms of the trade-offs, if I have to see it from a Turkish perspective, that ensures the neutrality of Cyprus. There will be a security backstop for Turkey as well, meaning that Cyprus will never be used for any as a base for anything against Turkey's own security. There could be an arrangement as part of the renewal of the British bases that any sort of information could be shared with Turkey as well, and that would satisfy Turkey's security concerns. There could be some more information sharing among the countries in the region. So all these elements could be built in favor of Turkey, and they wouldn't cost the two communities much in terms of security. Where I see the trade-off is, can we find two or three major countries around the world that can play the neutral guarantors, implementers in case anything goes wrong? So the same way that I presented a backstop for Turkey, we need a backstop for the Turkish Cypriots, a backstop for the Greek Cypriots, whereas everybody feels secure. And that's what we did with the experiment. We're trying to find three countries that are not Greece and Turkey, and we put them in the public opinion poll. And we found that in both sides, even though their preference on the Turkish Cypriots is for Turkey, if you offer countries like Canada, Australia, Japan, they will accept them. If you offer NATO, they will accept. If you offer countries in the European Union, they can also be part of the win-win packages. But you need to work on other dimensions as well, because by themselves are not sufficient. So you need to work on the settlement in its comprehensive form and incentivize the entire package.
Let me take another two questions here, pending one over here in the middle front row, and then the gentleman here at the end.
Thank you. Theo Theodorou. We talk about surveys of the citizens and so forth, but I can't see that being the way to a solution only, because as we know, the solution lies with one particular country, Turkey. And I think this is where the solution is. We know that the two communities can and will be able to live together. There's no doubt about that if we're allowed a secure environment to live in. No doubt about it. But there are other factors within that. I was going to go into the financial one. We're talking about a BBF with two constituent states. That's very costly to run. Very costly to run. Now, we're talking about a population of 1.1 or 2 million. What's our GDP? How are we going to be able to fathom to find income to cover two constituent states? Yeah, apart from everything else on investments and so forth, which we need. The solution should be a united Cyprus, a simple equation like any other EU nation, whereby it's one nation. No borders, no divisions, nothing. The European Union, like any state or any country in the world, yeah, we're trying to reinvent the solution. You can call it a BBF, but what is the content of the BBF? Because if we don't look at seriously these specific points, we're not going to go towards a solution, unfortunately. So I'll stop there. Otherwise, I have other issues on security and so forth.
United Cyprus, United Cyprus, but also equal representation of different communities. Aritik, can we have also a question here, last but not least?
Thank you very much. Thank you for giving me the floor, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the interesting presentations. There was an element I noticed of perhaps optimism about a solution, but I'm not so sure, and this is the question, what does solution mean? Solution, the word solution can have many definitions, and there are big powers involved in that part of the world as everywhere else, and each power has their own interpretation of solution for their own imperialist interest, because those powers are traditionally historical imperialist powers. So I don't see where this solution is, because NATO has been mentioned, the UN has been mentioned, the UN has been impotent since virtually since its creation. NATO, as much as it says it's a defense alliance, it's not. We have seen that on a number of occasions. And when Harold Macmillan became prime minister in January 1957, he was propagating partition because it was good old British Empire, divide and rule. When Lyndon Ben Johnson became president following the assassination of JFK in June 1964, he invited George Papandreou to the White House. George Papandreou went with the young Andreas Papandreou then. Okay.
Let's not cover the whole history.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So what I was going to say, LBJ said in no uncertain terms, he said he wanted Cyprus divided. George Papandreou wouldn't have it. Let me just finish quickly,
please.
Other people are... Henry Kissinger in 1974, sometime after 74, he said the solution of Cyprus was resolved in the summer of 1974. So nothing has really happened as such. And even when Cyrus Vance, Secretary of State, after...
No, sorry, I really have to stop here, but thank you so much. So we have the same question, I think, one about the United Cyprus and one about the permanent divided Cyprus. So a round of comments by the panel, and then we'll reward everybody with a glass of wine.
So what do you say to that? It's a good, it's a common question that many people in Cyprus raise. I would be interested to actually...
About the cost of...
Not just the cost, about, you know, why have a bi-zonal, bi-communal federation and not... Is it just the inability to get over the trust issues, I guess? I guess that's the answer, I guess, no?
It's an opportunity cost. When it comes to the cost, you're making an investment. And the hope is that with bizonal federation, you unite the island. You don't have any other option. You unite the island, and then you benefit from the cooperation, exploration of natural gas, joint developments, and so on. Now, on the Greek Cypriot side is... It's difficult to make this argument that it will cost more. If you have something like six municipalities in Nicosia and you break authorities with so many municipalities, I mean, you can find ways to save money by being more proactive and reducing the personnel in both sides. But what is important is what you have mentioned about decision making. There you need to find ways that if you face a major financial crisis or you have a major decision to be made, then the decision is being made. And again, these are all trade-offs. The same with NATO. Let's say you have a settlement tomorrow and the Turkish Cypriots come to you, you agree on everything, and says, we're ready to give up on the Turkish guarantees, but we want NATO to be involved somehow. And we explain how NATO will be involved. And you're a hardcore leftist who wants to have a CETAS as a peace settlement. You always fought the settlement. You are the person who went to every demonstration of AGEL in favor of the settlement. What do you do? Do you accept the Turkish Cypriot proposal or not? I mean, this is a hard decision. I wouldn't like to be on that option. And that's why I'm introducing third countries in my experiment. It would be a very, 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 very serious decision. Very serious trade-off. Or if one day you have a referendum and you know that Cyprus will be reunified and tomorrow you're going to be at your home, do you care about whether it's a federation or not? I mean, you just pack your luggage and you move to Cyprus and you take the risk. So it's all trade-offs in life. And this is what we face in politics, in real life. It's all trade-offs.
So conditional on having a, let's accept that you're going to have a bizonal, bicommunal federation. I think the cost, assuming that you have thought and have solutions to these institutional problems, which are very serious, I think the potential of the country from a global economic output point of view and also population is not going to be at just our 1.1 million. I think the country, you know, Sicily has like a population of more than 5 million people. It's not so Cyprus has a lot of land, has a lot of potential. The fact that, you know, there's The fact that this problem remains is a big impediment to economic growth, actually, and it will continue to be there. And you know, I didn't, you know, and it's, you know, that's the reason many people, even in Cyprus, do not have their money in Cyprus. People are not willing to accept that, but that's the reality of the situation, and they will not bring all their money back in Cyprus because they're afraid. Now, if, so the growth potential is there, and I think that, you know, so, and if you look back in history, when the time, you know, Famagusta was great, when Famagusta could bring Christians and Muslims together and they could trade, basically. So that's when the, you had the, you know, the big growth in the, on the island. The problem is you need to think through how to sort out these institutional gridlock problems ex ante. And it's not an easy thing. And my frustration is that, you know, this has been going on for 50 years, and I'm pretty willing to, you know, and this should be public information. It should not be some hidden, one, I don't think it exists in the negotiations. Yeah. Two, even if it does exist, it should be, you know, it should be transparent. I mean, yeah, it's like you're asking us to take a vote on, you know, jump, and then you're not telling us, is there going to be a net there or not? I mean, so, so that's kind of the big frustration.
Yeah. Their participation. You have diaspora, you have more than Dunkelberg. You have unheard. You have refugees all over the world, both Cypriot refugees, and we can't vote for the future in the referendum.
I think we promised in the blurb about the event that we will not resolve the issue today, and we definitely haven't resolved the issue. But I hope we highlighted quite a few of the dimensions that will
add to that. We're extending our service to the diaspora as well and the civic assemblies.
Yes.
Diaspora is extremely important. We
yes.
can all agree on that.
Okay, so before you join me in thanking the speakers in the usual way, let me say that there's a reception outside where we can continue the conversation. Thank you all for attending, and special thanks to the speakers.